just a baby. Before I could speak, I would line up all my letter blocks alphabetically. Now it's my vocation and my passion to assign every decimal numbered shelf to every decimal numbered spine. I'm
Good morning and welcome to The Library Show. My name is Brooke Schaefer. I'm your host this week, along with my co-host, Carrie Sagal, and we're joined in the studio today by our guest, Matt Goff. Thanks, Matt, for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
Today, we're going to be talking about, well, reading material, as usual, as we usually do on The Library Show. But before we jump into that, I kind of want to introduce listeners to you. For people who don't know you in town, you're known by many as the Barefoot Naturalist, and you have a radio show right here on Raven Radio. And you also have a PhD in math and teach math on occasion at the local university. Is all of that about right?
Yes, I have more schooling than probably anybody needs. And I do occasionally walk around barefoot. And I like to consider myself an aspiring naturalist. That's sort of once I was in school, I got interested in other things, and natural history being the one that I tend to obsess over these days.
So you mean you went to school not for, you know, natural history at all?
Actually, the last biology class I took was as a class was my freshman year in high school. With I took biology at the high school and marine biology with Mr. Foster.
Oh, Bill Foster.
Yeah, in 1989-90.
Okay, so you're from here. You were born and raised in Sitka. And you, I guess I was trying to make sense of what you said about getting into natural history when you were.
College. Okay. And I liked to hike because it was fun. And I started taking pictures of things. And then I discovered that I wanted to know what those things were. And that triggered my obsessive tendencies. And so that's how things kind of developed from there. And I'd never wanted to do math for math's sake. It was just always tools for me. And I, you know, got done with undergraduate and was like, well, I don't know what else I'm going to do. I'll go to graduate school. So I went to graduate school and got far enough along. I was kind of ready to be done, but it's far enough. You're like, seems to be kind of a shame to just quit now. So I was like, well, if I pass this test, then I'll finish it up. And I passed the test, so I had to finish it up. But and it's not really what I enjoy spending my time doing at this point.
It's not what you're passionate about.
Yeah. I mean, I have a lot of background in math and statistics both. And I enjoy statistics a little more than math. I enjoy both of them, but they're just not really, like, there's only so much you can do, in your time and energy. And those aren't the things that I prefer to devote my time and energy to for the most part.
So are you saying that when you were a kid or a teen, when you were walking the woods, you really didn't know what you were looking at all?
Yeah. I mean, there's a few things. It's really interesting to me to reflect back on that. And actually, one of the things I brought to read and share is related to that sort of experience of going back with different eyes from what you grew up. I played around in the woods. I went for hikes when I was in high school. We didn't hike much as a family, but I went hunting with my dad or fishing. And so there are individual things that I remember. I didn't know what they were, but like marbled murrelets. I remember, like, I have this memory of going out. Inevitably, it seemed like a gray morning on the water and calm because we didn't go out in rough water, and just zooming along in a skiff, and just kind of inevitably we're leaving at 4 in the morning or something ridiculous, because that's when my dad thought it was best to go fishing, and he was up that early, so everybody must want to be up that early. At least that's, from my younger years, that's the way that it felt. And I remember just kind of like, I don't know that literally my head was on the side of the boat, but that's kind of like, that's the image I have of myself and kind of just looking out there. And I would hum along to the motor, like the motor has a frequency, and I would like hum chords to it just because I was weird that way, I guess. Maybe other people do that. But these birds were in front, and they're just little brown birds, kind of dark birds, and they would just tip. And they would just tip into the water as we were going by. So I have memories of that. I didn't have any idea what they were. Now I know that they're marbled murrelets, but at the time I didn't. They're just something I had some vague awareness of.
So they made an impression on you. You didn't necessarily, like, you didn't make you wonder, oh, what is that?
Yeah, and now there was something that I noticed for whatever reason. You know, it's interesting what it is, the things that, that catch your eye. And I guess, I don't know, maybe if we want to read something, I'll just read that because it's kind of relevant to now. One of the things that what I like to read these days, I used to read a lot of books. I don't read books as much as I used to, but I keep up with a lot of weblogs. And I like to read weblogs that are, I read a whole bunch of different kind of weblogs, but the ones that I brought to share for this are natural history related. And so this one is from a weblog that is, the name of the weblog is Wandering Weta with Waterfowl and Weeds. And the author is, I think she's definitely in her 60s, maybe even pushing 70. When I first started reading, she was living, I think, in Vancouver, British Columbia. Her husband died within the last year or so, and she moved to Vancouver Island. And I have a couple different things that I thought would be interesting to read from her. But she writes pretty much a daily weblog, and she really enjoys getting out. She keeps an aquarium in her house, and as part of that, she goes down to the beach regularly to get stuff to feed the critters. But she, like I said, she recently moved back to Vancouver Island, and so this is the weblog post that she wrote about that, and it's titled "Better Late Than Never." It seems strange to me now, back living on Vancouver Island after an entire adult life away, how much I missed of my surroundings growing up. Halfway in the bush as I was, I knew the berries, which to eat, which to avoid. I knew that the coiled tops of springtime ferns tasted of nuts, a good nibble as I followed the trail to school. I knew the taste of Douglas fir tips in the spring and how to peel thimbleberry stalks for the first greens of the year. How to make pancakes with elderberry flowers in the batter. I waded in creeks lined with bleeding hearts. I fished for minnows on the tide flats, never wondering what fish they grew up to be. I teased crabs and starfish, knew how to eat a clam on the beach, banging it on a rock to open it like the gulls did. I caught perch and red snapper from the wharf and watched gulls fight over our leftover food set out for the dog. And I don't remember seeing mushrooms at all, ever. There were garden plots near two of our homes. There were daffodils and roses and some blue flowers that now I recognize as hydrangeas. Back then, I didn't think to ask their name. The rest of the flowers and other plants in the area slipped by me unobserved, and I never, ever saw a hermit crab or learned the names of the multicolored anemones on all the rocks. Wasted opportunities. I'm glad that now I have a chance to fill in some of those gaps. And so the rest of the post is her sharing photos of things that she's photographed recently and making comments. And one in particular, I guess I'll you know, just read the caption to. It's an old post, like in a meadow, and of course, as old wooden things and really anything else is prone to, it's covered in lichens. And she just says, let's see, what did she say? And this, I have trouble understanding. How did I ever miss seeing lichens in all those years? It's just, they're just so common. So it's that sense of really mystery about how is it that you're just so unaware of those things that had to have been there. You know, you had to have known them at some level. Dark-eyed junco here, most common bird around the neighborhoods in the winter. And I know that now. I have no memory at all of those. The first memory I have of those is from 1998. I have a picture of one, and I actually, it's on my old website, and it's still there. You can find a picture, and it says, I saw these birds in the muskeg. Basically, I have no idea what they are. Mm-hmm. And you know, whether they're common or uncommon. And now, of course, I know that they're exceptionally common. If you have a feeder, which we didn't, but, you know, they're still running around, flying around the neighborhoods. I cannot possibly have not seen them at some point. Right. I did a paper route for 5 years. They must have been there, but I have no memory.
That's what I like about, I think what's what you've talked, when we've maybe gone hiking before, you've mentioned that that's what you read from this woman makes me think a lot about what you have talked about in your own experience of becoming a naturalist or an aspiring naturalist, where, like the example you just gave too, these things were all around you and you were aware of things that you were using or that were part of your everyday life, and kind of like the woman, Wanda. But it wasn't until, you know, much later that you just slowly began asking questions about the things you saw. So there was a shift in you at some point, and that's kind of how, I remember you describing that that's how you know, anyone can become a naturalist as you just start, instead of just walking along and seeing the grass. You see the grass and then you kind of say, huh, I wonder what that is.
Yeah. I mean, really, it fundamentally being or becoming a naturalist, I guess, and becoming, it's really just being curious. And it's, and as kids, you're curious. You know, we learned some things for Sea Week or whatever. And so I learned some things. I remember there's a seaweed, I think it's Halosakian is the genus name, but they're just, they're little tubes about a couple inches long. And when the tide goes out, they're usually partially filled with water. And if you pick those and you squeeze them, they have little micropores at the end and they squirt. And of course we knew what those did.
Yeah.
And I have memories of those, right? I have no idea what they're called. They were just the squirting seaweed we could squirt each other with.
So we had the clover. I don't know, Carrie, if you had anything from your youth, but
we sucked clover. I sucked clover. I had the experience in college. I took a plant taxonomy course and realizing for the first time that I'd ever had any learning realized could change your life, because I couldn't walk across campus anymore without spending a lot of time looking around. And before, I'd just gone to my destination, said hi to my friends, looked around at what was going on in campus, and suddenly I was seeing the world around me, and it was due to maybe having a name for things I was looking at. I think that beyond using and sucking clover, but having a name for something you see helps you remember it, helps you see it.
It gives you like a file drawer in your head, you know, where you can tag information in some way. And it doesn't have to be, like in my view, it doesn't have to be an official name. You know, it doesn't have to be. I mean, it helps you to communicate with other people. But, you know, as kids, it's like that seaweed that you could squirt people with. That was a fine name. Like, we knew what we were talking about if we talked about that, right? So, and even if you didn't know, you probably knew what clover was called, because that's within the sort of public consciousness enough, you know, four-leaf clovers being lucky and things like that. But there are other little things. You know, the watermelon berries were soft enough that you could throw them and they would explode a little bit. So that's something kids would be into. And we didn't have to, I didn't have to know that that was Streptopus amplexifolius like I do now, or, you know, clasping twisted stalk for the English name. But I was aware of those berries, and they, and so there was something there, that allowed me to sort of tag them, I guess, and not necessarily communicate with a botanist about that unless I could describe them and they were familiar. But anybody who had experience with them would go, oh, yeah, all right, I know what you're talking about. So that's kind of fun.
Do you think it's your kind of obsessive nature that has shifted you into...
Oh, that's what started me. So I started taking pictures. My dad used to take pictures when I was a kid, not a lot, but every once in a while he'd, you know, we'd go on vacation. He had this SLR camera and he'd like to do macro photos of flowers. And I honestly don't know why that appealed to me, but at some level it appealed to me. And I asked for a camera for like graduation in 1996 or something. And I got it was a nice point and shoot, but it wasn't, I was like, oh, I wanted to, like, I was hoping to do macro. And they're like, oh, we didn't realize that. So I bought myself an SLR camera in, I think, 1997 or 98, one of those 2 years. And I took a bunch of pictures. Like, the first hike I went on after I had that, I hiked up Gavin Hill to Harbor Mountain. And so I took pictures of flowers along the way. I probably still have the negatives from that roll of film. And, you know, it's a different time. You didn't get to see them right away. So it was a, you know, a week or so, and I got the photos developed and looked at the pictures, and I was like, I knew blueberries or whatever, but I also have pictures of this yellow flower, and it's like, well, what's that? And it turns out it was Cooley's buttercup, but I didn't know that at the time. I think I bought Pojarn McKinnon's book, Plants of the Pacific Northwest Coast, and did photo keying. I just looked through photos that matched, and this is how I got started. There wasn't as much on the internet in terms of resources at that time. This was like late 90s.
How did you keep track? Did you like write notes on the back of the photo, or did you make notes in your key?
No, you know, that's interesting. I started a website. And actually, so I started my first website. I was in graduate school in 1998, and I started posting my pictures there. And I was taking statistics classes, and coincidentally, there was a number of botany students. And I feel a little bad because they were so polite, and I just kept asking them, like, do you know what this is? Because, like, naively thinking that if they were botany students, they must know what every plant is, right? Turns out not to be the case. But they were very polite and did their best to, you know, like, there's no reason that they should have had any idea what the plants are in Southeast Alaska. You know, they're from somewhere else and probably studying some particular plant in the lab kind of thing. But they're like, well, that looks kind of like a buttercup maybe. And so like, so Cooley's Buttercup was one of the ones that I struggled with the first time. It's got the yellow flowers, but has a lot of petals, and it blooms really early in the year, up, almost exclusively up high. You can find it at some cold spots down lower. And if you go up hiking much after the snow has melted, you won't see it because it you can see the plant, but you won't necessarily notice it. Because when you're first starting, what you tend to notice is flowers, you know, colorful things and flowers being one of those, or fruits. And so, I didn't intend to get obsessed, but I have that sort of, thing going for me where like I feel compelled. It wasn't enough for me to say, oh, look, pretty mountain flowers. I was like, well, what is it? And once I started down that road, so for me, it's been hand-in-hand photography and learning natural history. And then putting everything on my website is how I remember it.
How has having the internet changed your experience of observing the natural world?
Well, for some things like insects, there's resources available, like expert resources through websites called bugguide.net or iNaturalist. And there are people that are, you know, experts in relatively esoteric fields, say, mites, parasitic mites, you know, the little red mites that you might see on things, like that's what they study. And so you can take a picture and they won't probably be able to tell you what the species is. But they can tell you as much as can be told from the photo. Moths were one that I started, like I would post because I would have no idea. And I don't have any interest in learning to key things out. I don't have any interest in learning the technical language required to do the technical identification work. I think a lot of things, especially when you're so hyper-focused on an area like I am, a lot of things you can learn to recognize because they aren't the same as other things here. They're similar to things somewhere else, but I'm not somewhere else.
Sort of just sight recognition.
Yeah, yeah. You get to know them. That's kind of how I think about it. You get to know them, and I don't know how to tell the difference between a white spruce and a Sitka spruce. I just know that we have Sitka spruces here. And probably if I saw a white spruce, I'd say there's something funny about that because I'm familiar enough with Sitka spruces that it wouldn't seem right. You know, it's kind of like getting to know somebody that you know really well. Like, you would recognize their voice sounds funny on the phone, and maybe it isn't them. But somebody you sort of know, you'd be like, maybe you would mistake somebody else for them that you would never do with somebody that you were, you know, you knew really well. And so I think the same thing happens with, you know, plants and animals that you kind of get to know as you're just spending time looking.
Matt, you said you had a number of blogs
Yes.
that you followed. Did you want to share another blog, or do you want to leap into your book?
Well, I brought one especially for Brooke, and I know how Brooke likes. This is a short one, so let me pull this up here. Where did it go?
I am curious, though.
Yeah.
Did you get into reading weblogs because you began your own website? Was this kind of the next step of?
Well, partly that, but also partly I am. Weblogs are nice and short. Partly it was my obsession with what other people were seeing in Southeast, but there's not a lot of stuff being, you know, published weblog-wise from Southeast Alaska. But partly it's easier for me to read without being compulsive about reading it all. You know, I can read a weblog in a few minutes, whereas, and if I read a novel, and I tend to read novels in one sitting, Harry Potter took me 17 hours. The last Harry Potter novel, I think, when I read that was 17 hours. I read it straight through.
Yeah.
So it was all night and into the next day. That doesn't work very well when you have to maintain a certain amount of like family obligations and that kind of thing. So that's part of why as well. But there's just a lot of interesting, you know, it sparks your curiosity. The Wandering Weta that I read before, one of the things that she wrote about was communicating with the hermit crabs in her aquarium, and I thought that was like, who knew? But that was fascinating.
That sounds nuts to me, Matt.
It does, but it was really well. I'll read that one too, but first I'm going to read this one. This one is for Brooke, and this is from the Scientific American website, and I can't remember what her name is, the author of this. I might find it here at the end. And so I'll show you guys here the pictures and kind of describe them. This is titled Predator, No Problem, Water Fleas Grow Weapons. And so here's the picture that leads this. And so I'll just describe it for folks. On one side, there's this little sort of semi-translucent creature with a big eye, kind of round pot belly, sharp tail. And that's a water flea. And on the other side is a very similar looking thing, but with all these really spiky ornaments on it. And so it says, you know, undefended, Daphnia lumholtzii, which is the name of these things, and then defended. The apparatus is Daphnia's way of saying, really, I'm quite stringy and unappetizing to the three-spined stickleback fish that eats them. So this is, so Brooke, I'm sure you'll know right away why I wrote this for you, thought of you when I read this. Mm-hmm. Cuteness, though unquestionably an awesome force of nature, is no defense against predators. So the water flea, Daphnia, takes matters into its own hands by growing its own helmets and spikes in the presence of chemical cues that a predator is near. Above, you can see an unarmed Daphnia lumholtzii at left and a punk rocker Daphnia on the right. And so this is I won't read the whole thing here, but this is one of those, she's a science writer, and so she takes research that other people have done and then presents it for a more lay audience, and you know.
This is one of the things that you as a naturalist have struggled with, is identifying cuteness, and so that's something that we've talked a little bit about, and I think you kind of tried to like parse it out to like big eyes and maybe roundness. And this
oversized
one has
eyes and roundness,
belly.
And it does, but it's no defense against predators, no matter how cute they may be.
Right.
So when I read that first sentence, it's like, I got to bring that to the library show because I know that will be appreciated.
And I appreciate the fact that you're getting so much better at identifying cuteness. I feel like you really are making strides.
Yeah. Well, and so that's a really, she's a really interesting writer to me, not because the stuff is like that probably does happen here. But it's at a microscopic level that I don't pay much attention to because it's really small. But there's a lot of just interesting, like, wow, the world is stranger than I would have guessed sort of things that she tends to highlight.
And then what about the woman who interacted?
Oh yeah. So here's this one is by, again, Wandering Weta is the name. I don't actually know that she ever gives her real name. And this is titled Tap Talking to Patients. I know how to speak hermit crab, she's exclamation mark. This is something she's excited about. I just managed to suggest a good idea and actually get it across. I am supposed to be posting one photo and going off to bed. Tomorrow's another very busy day, but I can't wait to tell this story. It started sometime after Christmas when all the kids were coming for dinner. I'd counted all the animals in my tank and made a list for them. Could they find every one? There were 11 hermit crabs in three species. Grainy hand hermits with blue spots, hairy hermits, black and white, and the tiny green mark hermits with the orange highlights. Sometime in February, I counted again. I couldn't find all the grainy hands, and a couple of them seemed rather lethargic. I monitored them for a while until a few died, then a few hairy hermits, too. I changed the water and moved empty shells and watched. More died. And the rest of the grainy hands, my favorites for their personality, their curiosity, and mutual helpfulness, looked sick. They lay around, barely moving, not eating. I removed them to a bowl with clean water, a hospital bowl. I babied them, changing their water twice daily, tempting them with bits of food, which they ignored. All but one of them died anyhow. The one, whom I'm calling Patience for now, although I'm not sure of her sex, rested in the bowl for a week, lying upside down in the shell, barely even moving her mouth parts. But she didn't die, and gradually seemed more alert. After some time, she started to be interested in food again, but couldn't walk. When I positioned her shell in walking position, she struggled a bit, slid around, then the shell rolled out of control again, and she ended up with her feet up. There she stayed, day in and day out. I fed her in this position. Finally, none of the remaining hermits in the tank, all small hairies and green marks, seemed sick. Maybe the epidemic had run itself out. I returned her to the tank. She liked that. She lay on her back, catching at pieces of seaweed that floated past and nibbling on it. She was active enough. She stretched and twisted, reaching for seaweed, pulling it towards her, but always still lying upside down. Several times a day, I rolled her over into walking position. She would start working on the shells and sand, picking up things she found, but when she tried to walk to the next spot, she scrabbled uselessly on the sand until she ended up back on her back again. I thought that maybe she is weaker now. She needs to gain weight and strength again. That big shell might be just too heavy for her. I found her a few smaller shells of the type she likes and laid them close at hand for her, but she didn't seem to get the idea. I've been remembering how one hermit convinced another to trade shells. He held the other's shell face to face, then jerked it and clicked it against his shell. Could I do that? Tonight, I took Patience out of the tank and held her loosely in my hand, but underwater. She seemed contented enough, picking at the skin of my thumb, tasting it. I picked out the best of the smaller shells and tapped her face opening with it gently, gently. She retreated into her shell, and I repeated the tapping. Nothing happened. I put her back in the tank beside the proposed home. She reached for it, then slipped and rolled onto her back again. I tried again. I held her with my hand just under the surface of the tank water and tapped again, once. Suddenly, she slipped out of her big shell, rolled up and off my hand into the tank. I put the small shell down beside her and kept the big one, and she didn't even bother to examine the new shell. She just popped into it, rolled it over to the walking position, and hurried off to get a bite to eat. Yay! She can't be happier than I am, and she is happy. She's been wandering here and there, nibbling at everything she finds. Here she is, a few minutes after the switch. And then there's a little picture of her there. So,
right side up.
Yeah, right side up. And so it's just, you know, it's this relationship that this woman developed with a hermit crab, you know, that she was keeping. Not unlike, you know, people would with dogs or cats or any other pet.
Do you communicate with Ouida?
No, I don't. I mean, I've left a comment on her weblog, I think once when she asked about identifying something that I recognized. But otherwise, I just, you know, it's a passive reading of it.
I thought you were going to ask Harry if he communicated with any critters.
With hermit, do you?
Are there any critters you communicate?
No, ravens? I'm not so good at that. No, I mean, not in any ways that are obvious to me. Let's put it that way. I try not to scare them off when I'm taking pictures and things like that, but...
So what is the book that you've brought?
Well, so the book that I brought, the actual like paper book, is called Language Making Nature by David Lucas. And David Lucas is actually a professional naturalist. Probably the best way to introduce it a little bit is just to read part of his introduction. I remember as a child and as a young budding naturalist spending all my time observing and testing the world around me, moving pieces, altering the flow of things, and documenting the way the world responded to me. Now, as an adult and a professional naturalist, I've approached language in the same way. Not from an academic point of view, but as a curious child, still building little mud dams and creeks and chasing after frogs. So this book is an odd thing. It is a naturalist's walk through the language-making landscape of the English language. And following in the naturalist tradition, it combines observation, experimentation, speculation, and documentation, activities we don't normally associate with language. This book is about testing, experimenting, and playing with language. It is a handbook of tools and techniques for taking words apart and putting them back together again in ways that I hope are meaningful and legitimate, or even illegitimate. This book is about peeling back layers in search of the language-making energy of our time. It is about the gaps in meaning that we urgently need to notice and name, the places where our dreams and ideals are no longer fulfilled by a society that has become fast-paced and hyper-commercialized. So I'll skip and just read the last paragraph of this introduction part. In our busy modern lives, we have largely forgotten that language is meant to be inventive and playful, that beneath the veneer of modernity, I don't know how you pronounce that word officially, but the English language is potent with ancient magic-making power. Throughout this book, I will refer repeatedly to play, but I'm not speaking about play as something trivial. I'm speaking of play as something profoundly creative and freeing. And underneath everything, this playful exploration of language is about dissent, about rising up and crying out in support of that which is alive and vital. This book is about imagination and truth-telling and contemplation. It is an undertaking that is fierce, creative, and honest. So I haven't read a lot of this book, but like the parts that I've read have been interesting.
And were you turned on to it because you knew of the author as a naturalist?
No, this actually I learned about from another weblog that I read, by a guy who lives in Portland. And he wrote about it, and he actually was writing about it in a context. He said they were having a gathering of folks there where they would go through, and each time they gathered, they would take one chapter and they would essentially play, you know, use that rule or tool or whatever that was described there and do some language, you know, playing,
games.
I guess,
yeah.
Games with that, which I thought was kind of interesting.
So we'll have to make the name of that one available for listeners.
Okay, yeah.
So
this is called Language Making Nature.
Okay, great.
By David Lucas. And I don't, he self-published it, I think, because I ordered it through his website.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, if you listeners out there have been enjoying listening to Carrie and myself talking with Matt, you can tune in later this morning to hear more conversation.
Actually, this afternoon at 1:30.
Okay, 1:30 for Matt's show. We're going to be switching microphones around, and Matt will be in charge, and Carrie and I will be trying to talk. So thanks for tuning into the Library Show. Have a wonderful morning.